Lecture 17, The Legions of Rome.
From the terrifying killing machine of the Macedonian Royal Army, we now turn our attention to the terrifying killing machine of the Roman Legion, the single most effective tactical unit of the ancient battlefield. In this lecture, we explore the origins of the Legion, its organization and equipment, and the difficult matter of its tactical system in the period of Rome's intense imperial expansion, that is, in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. The Legion was the basic military unit of ancient Rome in all ages. The Latin legio merely means selection or muster, and it actually denotes the act of raising troops from among those eligible to serve. Such levies were early divided into units put under different commanders, and these units eventually came to be designated legions in their own right. By the Middle Republic, roughly between about 300 and 133 BC, the legion became an independent tactical fighting unit comprised predominantly of heavy infantry, but also including light-armed skirmishers, engineers, and cavalry. In the following century, roughly 133 to 30 BC, the legions further evolved into quasi-professional regiments, and under the principate, that is to say, the rule of the emperors between 30 BC and about 284, these regiments were made permanent, transcending the generations of recruits who served in them. The Romans were thus the first to discover the motivational power of a soldier's loyalty to a unit that bore its own insignia, history, and its own traditions, and with it, the power of competition between units for glory, battle honours, and recognition. In this respect, the Roman Legion is the ancient ancestor of the Royal Fusiliers or the US Marine Corps. The earliest phases of the Legion's history are shrouded in a mystery, since the sources for the earlier periods of Roman history before about 300 BC are not very good, as discussed in more detail in my History of Ancient Rome course. The collage of moralizing legend, folk memory, and colorful anecdote that passes for early Roman history is such that some scholars term it myth history. Only the general outlines of Rome's early military dispositions can be made out from the Augustan Age authors Livy or Dionysius of Halicarnassus, supplemented by Greek comparanda and scattered archaeological evidence. Until the testimony of Polybius becomes available in the 2nd century BC, Roman military practice can only be dimly discerned. Initially, it seems, noble families raised and commanded their own war bands. Romulus, the founder of Rome, reputedly had 300 celeres, or fast men, around him, and the aristocratic house of the Fabii raised a private army from their dependents to fend off Etruscan attacks in the early 5th century BC, if we believe the Roman accounts. This ancient practice may stand behind the ability of later aristocrats to muster nobles from their lands with such relative ease. Now, Rome's very early armies were undoubtedly small-scale and mostly comprised of infantry. Italian archaeology suggests a wide variety of equipment prevailed among these early warriors, a feature that also long endured in the Legion's history, variety of equipment. We have no really reliable information about how such warband armies might have actually fought, and a Homeric mode of combat is certainly possible, but there's no need to re-enter that swamp of controversy here. At some early date, probably under the influence of the Etruscans, the Romans adopted the hoplite phalanx. Ivory plaques from the town of Palestrina in Latium show men in hoplite equipment, and scattered archaeological evidence suggests the widespread presence of hoplites in Italy in the 5th and 4th centuries BC. But they would have been confined mostly to the settled plains. Archaeology has yielded a bewildering variety of weaponry, helmet types, and shield shapes, which demonstrates that in ancient Italy, uniformity was the exception to the rule. This variety later gave the Romans an ample menu of equipment options to select from. Both Livy and Dionysius attribute major military reforms to King Servius Tullius in the 6th century BC, but this may be read as little more than the myth historical shorthand for a very long time ago. Their accounts of the so-called Servian reform appear to derive from a common source, so they convey at least an established tradition about it. The reform involved classing citizens by wealth and age group into different categories of troop organized into units called centuries, nominally 100 strong. The first class, for instance, comprised men worth 100,000 in coin and armed with helmet, round shield, greaves, breastplate, spear, and sword. In other words, hoplites. Such men, we are told, formed 80 centuries, or 8,000 men in theory. Members of Class 2 were assessed at 75,000 in coin and were armed with helmet, oblong shield, greaves, spear and sword, that is, a lighter variety of hoplite. These formed 20 centuries, or 2,000 men in theory. And so on for five classes of infantry, to which were added 18 centuries of equites, that means cavalry horsemen, and 2 centuries each of engineers and musicians, and one of a group called Capitacense, or headcount, who were not obligated to serve in the ranks at all, since they were unable to supply their own equipment. The Servian reform cannot describe a deployable field army. A simple observation makes this obvious. As a rule, ancient stratified societies contained far fewer wealthy people than poorer ones, and virtually no middle class. Yet in the Servian reform, the wealthy men of the first class are supposed to provide 80 centuries of infantry, while the presumably more numerous men of the second to fifth classes only 20 centuries each, for a total of 80 between them. This makes no military sense. And why are the headcount there at all, since they didn't serve in the army? The answer is that the Servian reform describes a political rather than a military scheme, namely the organization of one of the Roman Republic's voting assemblies. This was the centuriate assembly, in which citizens voted in blocks called centuries that were distributed in such a way as to favor the rich, exactly as reflected in the century to class allotments charted in Livy and Dionysius. That is, the fewer people of the rich first class got 80 votes, and then the second, third, fourth, and fifth classes got 80 votes between them in that particular assembly. Now, the military flavor of this assembly probably led a later writer to retro-engineer a supposed Servian military system from this political blueprint. This source then informed our surviving accounts. Now, the associations in the Servian reform between property, military service, and political participation do strongly suggest that a hoplite phalanx stood behind the original reform, since just such associations are found in better documented Greek contexts. If so, citizens would really have been divided into only 2 categories: those who could afford the hoplite equipment and those who could not. So it does seem likely that the surviving accounts of the Servian reform enshrined some features of early Roman military practice, even if they were misunderstood by later authors and presented anachronistically. Later, the Romans abandoned the phalanx in favour of a more complex tactical military deployment based around maniples. Manipulus in Latin simply means a handful, but in the legion it designated a unit of 2 centuries of 60 or 30 men each. 3 maniples made up a cohort, which at this stage was a purely administrative grouping with no tactical function. The transition to maniples likely occurred sometime in the 4th century BC, either in response to the disastrous defeat at the hands of the Gauls in 390 BC, or during Rome's difficult wars with the mountain people of the Samnites later in that century. Whether the Romans invented the maniple or picked it up from the Italians is also not clear. Our best source for the Roman army of the Middle Republic is the Greek historian Polybius. Writing as an eyewitness around 150 BC, Polybius describes the legion's recruitment, organization, and equipment. The legion, says Polybius, was comprised of 4,200 foot, 5,000 in emergencies, and 300 horse. The 2 consuls, elected annually, held military command, and subordinate to them were also officers that were elected, called military tribunes. 6 of these served per legion. Recruitment of the rank and file soldiers proceeded in a way not unlike picking teams in a playground. All of those eligible to serve were assembled and then chosen by the military tribunes, making selections in rotation. Since the soldiers provided their own arms, this procedure ensured that each legion had a balanced mix of troops in age, class, and equipment. Each legion contained 5 categories of troops, 4 infantry and 1 cavalry. The youngest were the 1,200 light-armed skirmishers called velites, or the fast ones. These were mostly teenagers, armed with a round shield, a helmet covered with an animal skin, often that of a wolf, several 4-foot-long javelins, and sometimes a sword if they could afford one. Slightly older recruits were men in their 20s, and they were called hastati, which means spearmen. They were also 1,200 strong, but now organized into 10 maniples of 2 60-man centuries apiece. They carried a large oval convex shield called the scutum, perhaps adapted from a type used by the Celts. A remarkably well-preserved example was found in 1900 in the Fayum in Egypt, and it accords very closely with both Polybius's description of the shield and with depictions of it in sculpture. The Fayum shield was almost 4 feet high and nearly 2 feet wide. It was made of three layers of birch strips glued perpendicular to each other, and then the whole covered with cloth stitched through the rim. The top and bottom edges of the shield were reinforced with iron strips. The shield was gripped by a handle in the centre. On the front, a projecting boss, often made of metal, protected the handle. Reconstructions of the shield suggest it weighed about 20 pounds, and it was likely a weapon unto itself, used to knock foes over. Hastati wore helmets with cheek pieces for the face and plumes of horsehair and feathers to increase their height. They also wore a simple round or square breastplate called the pectorale that covered only the vitals of the chest. The wealthiest could afford chainmail coats, which, like the shield, may have been adapted from the Celts. Now, chainmail offered excellent protection, but weighed almost 35 pounds. Usually, only the forward leg, the left leg, was protected with a greave, that is to say, a piece of metal that clamped on the shin from the knee down to the ankle. And that's because, presumably, most protection was afforded by the large shield. As offensive weapons, Hastati carried two javelins called pila, one heavy and one light. The peculiar feature of the pilum was that the upper third of its length was comprised entirely of a barbed point. The pilum would easily then transfix any flesh that it hit, or if it became embedded in a shield, the elongated point would buckle, making the weapon useless and also an encumbrance to the enemy. Finally, Hastati carried the short Spanish sword, the Gladius Hispaniensis, which the Romans probably picked up from Spanish mercenaries serving with the Carthaginian armies during the Punic Wars. It was good for both cutting and for thrusting. That a well-preserved example from a 4th century Spanish cemetery looks almost identical to later Roman types suggests that the sword's design was adopted virtually intact from the original prototype. Early examples have a wasted blade, and the blade is about 1.5 feet long or so, but later on a more straight-sided blade was to become common. It seems likely as well that the Roman legionary of Polybius's day carried a dagger called a pugio, although Polybius doesn't make mention of it. The third class of infantrymen, called principes, or first-liners, were equipped exactly as the Hastati, but they were a little bit older, that is, they were in their late 20s or 30s. They too were organized into 10 maniples of 60 men centuries. Men in their 40s and older provided the fourth and final type of infantryman. These were termed triarii, or third-liners, and wore the same panoply as the Hastati and the Principes, except that the javelins were replaced now by a stabbing spear called the Hasta. Centuries of triarii were only 30 men strong, or half-strength, and so the maniples of triarii were only 60 men apiece. The backbone of the legion was provided by the centurions, commanders of the legion's 30 centuries. Whereas the consuls or tribunes were noblemen, centurions were elevated rankers equivalent to modern NCOs. They were elected by the rank and file, and so were men whom the troops clearly trusted and who had proven leadership qualities. The first centurion elected was named the chief centurion of the whole legion. He was called the primus pilus, and he was entitled to participate in military councils of war with the noble officers, with the tribunes and the consul himself. Each centurion then appointed a second-in-command called an optio and a standard-bearer for his century called a signifer. Polybius comments that, in choosing their centurions, the Romans looked not so much for the daring or fire-eating type, but rather men who are natural leaders and possess a stable and imperturbable temperament. Not men who will open the battle and launch attacks, but those who will stand their ground even when worsted or hard-pressed, and will die in defense of their posts. Centurions were tough and steady. The legion was mainly an infantry unit and only had 300 horse attached to it, divided into 10 squadrons called turmae. The cavalrymen were equipped with helmet, round shield, and lance. A typical consular army comprised two legions of citizen conscripts and the same number of non-citizen allies drawn from among the Italians that the Romans had conquered. These were ordered to muster at a certain time and place and were placed under a Roman officer called a prefect. Allied infantry were called wings, ally, which implies that they were stationed on either side of the legions in battle. Allies were equipped just like the legionaries, and deployed also in maniples. Polybius reports that the Allies provided three times more cavalry than the Romans, which means that a standard consular army consisted of almost 17,000 foot and 2,400 horse. Polybius ends his account of the Roman army with a detailed description of the fortified marching camp. No matter where it was pitched, the camp was both secure and familiar, since it was surrounded by a ditch and a palisade, and each unit had a fixed location in its ground plan. This meant that under normal conditions, Roman armies would be well rested before engaging the enemy, a significant advantage in any age, but even more so in the context of edged weapon clashes where physical stamina was vital. For all his detail on thoroughness, however, it is extremely regrettable that Polybius does not explain how the manipular legion fought its battles. In other words, we don't know how the Romans won the battles that built their empire. We address this problem next. While Polybius provides no systematic survey of Roman battle tactics, he does drop hints here and there. He comments that, for instance, that the first centurion elected to each maniple commanded the right-hand century and the second commanded that on the left. In battle, it seems, the two centuries of a maniple fought side by side. However, Livy, under the year 340 BC, does offer a systematic account of how the manipular legion fought battles, but on inspection his account proves difficult. Here is what Livy says. The legion deployed in three lines, with two in reserve. The maniples of the Hastati made up the first line, the Principes the second line, and the Triarii the third line, hence their name, the third liners. This arrangement, following Caesar's terminology, is usually dubbed the Acius Triplex, or the triple battle line. Behind the Triarii, Livy adds two further lines of not terribly impressive troops, Rorarii, or skirmishers, and people called Acensi, or attendants. These two rearmost lines instantly raise problems. Acensi normally means attendants without any military function, and why Rorarii, skirmishers, should be behind the three main battle lines and not in front of them is incomprehensible. We know that the Velites, also skirmishing troops, went out in front, harassed the enemy, and provided a screen behind which the main body would deploy. Such a role is amply attested for light-armed troops throughout classical warfare, and Livy, in fact, elsewhere calls the Velites the first front in battle. This normal forward skirmishing position of the Velites makes the fighting role of Livy's rearward skirmishers all the more baffling. He appears to be confused. But the real problems start when Livy turns to the details of the Acius Triplex itself. He states that each maniple was stationed at a distance from its neighbours equal to its own frontage. That is, there were regular gaps of 60 to 100 feet down the length of the Roman battle line. If the Hastati failed to win the day, Livy writes, they would retire through the gaps in the line of Principes behind them, who then engaged the enemy. So the second line, too, maintained gaps in its length. If the Principes failed to win, Livy continues, the fighting came to the Triarii. Up to this point, they had been kneeling behind their shields, their spears anchored in the ground, pointing forward. Now, having received the Hastati and Principes through the intervals in their line, they rose, closed ranks, and advanced. Now, references to these gaps are found in other writers who make it clear that the maniples of each line covered the gaps in the line in front. So looked at from above, then, the manipular deployment resembled a checkerboard pattern, and so was often termed in modern books a quincunx, which is a Latin term describing the five face of a die, although that word is not used by the ancients themselves to describe the manipular deployment. It's a modern coinage. Now, there are three scenarios for making sense of Livy's description. The first is to accept it more or less as is. The legions of the Middle Republic fought with gaps in their battle line and through discipline and training succeeded in carrying out difficult and dangerous maneuvers right in the face of the enemy. The effectiveness of Livy's procedure is easy to imagine. A fully engaged enemy would constantly be fighting Romans who appeared to be in retreat, but all the time stabbing and cutting and thrusting, only to face new and fresh legionaries at distressing intervals. By the time they came to the Triarii, the enemy would be demoralized and exhausted, and yet here was another fresh batch of Romans to take on. There is no doubt at all that line relief was a characteristic feature of the manipular system. It is emphasized by both Polybius, remember again an eyewitness, and Livy at several junctures in their battle descriptions. The problem lies in envisioning how on earth an ancient battle line could function with large gaps in its frontage. Even with the line behind covering the gaps in front, the dangers threatening the engaged maniples are obvious. They risked being flanked, surrounded, and destroyed in detail. It is very troubling indeed that generals of the Renaissance, excited by the rediscovery of the ancient classics and fighting edged weapon battles themselves, attempted to recreate the manipulars, the system described by Livy, and could not make it work. Nevertheless, several scholars maintain that the battle line with gaps was how the Roman legions won their battles. The second scenario is to accept the essence of Livy's account, but to modify it. Even if Livy accurately describes how the maniples were deployed going into battle, they need not have maintained this formation once actually engaged. Given the tactical risks of the gaps, perhaps they were closed just before contact with the enemy was made. Several scholars argue that the two sentries of each maniple were stationed one behind the other. And just prior to contact, the rear maniple moved sideways and came forward to plug the gap adjacent to the front sentry, thus forming a solid battle line. Then, on a signal, the Hastati would pull back through the gaps in the Principes' maniples, whose rear sentries then move forward and plug the gaps in their line, and so on. As we have seen already, Polybius implies that the two sentries of a maniple fought side by side, which would accord well with this reconstruction. This scenario then has the legion, on point of contact, becoming a sort of phalanx. However, we hear nothing of such a crucial role for sentries in manipular battles. Rather, the most basic tactical unit is always the maniple. And why would the forward maniples of the Hastati maintain gaps at all if they were to be plugged on contact? Why not have the forward line solid from the get-go? Further, such manoeuvres would require split-second timing. A mistimed closure of gaps risked, if it were too fast, trapping the retreating troops between the advancing enemy and the receiving line, or if it were too slow, exposing the receiving line to assault before its gaps had been closed. Either outcome could spell confusion and disaster. It has been argued that natural lulls in the fighting allowed such manoeuvres to be performed, but it seems highly unlikely that an enemy would sit idly by while the Romans swapped out tired troops for fresh ones. Finally, that the Hastati and the Principes actually fought with the gaps maintained in their lines is implied by Livy's wording. Listen to what he says about the actions of the Triarii. When they had received the Hastati and Principes into the gaps in their ranks, the Triarii would rise up, and after closing ranks and shutting off the lanes, as it were, immediately fall upon the enemy in one continuous line, there now being no hope left behind them. End quote. In Livy's mind, at least, only the Triarii fought in an unbroken line, and they did so only because they were the line of last resort. By implication, the Hastati and Principes fought in the line with gaps in it, which brings us back to the problems already raised for scenario number one. So a third scenario is to argue that Livy is so deeply confused that his whole description has to be thrown out. Unlike Polybius, Livy was not a man of affairs. He was, and always remained, a rather bookish type, well removed from public, never mind military life. As far as we know, he never served in the ranks, nor even witnessed a battle. It has been suggested, for instance, that his artificially mechanical and neat account describes parade ground manoeuvres rather than actual battle conditions. Ejecting Livy may appear to be a wholly negative position that leaves us no closer to understanding Roman tactical procedure than at the start, but it does have the distinct virtue of forcing us to look very closely for clues in specific battle narratives, particularly those in Polybius. My own view is that the manipular system aimed at flexibility in tactical deployment. It is unarguable that the deployment in three lines accommodated some sort of line relief system. The flexibility lay in how a commander arranged the maniples both in relation to each other and to the other elements of his army. And the gaps might not have been as huge a problem as many imagine. Xenophon tells how the 10,000 flanked one enemy by passing them in column with gaps maintained between the companies. But the enemy could not exploit these gaps due to the support offered by the company's relative proximity to each other. Perhaps the Roman manipular system worked on the same psychological principle. The mutual support of the maniples was sufficient to deter enemy exploitation of the gaps. From the enemy's perspective, rushing into a space with Romans on three sides may not have been a very appealing prospect. Adrian Goldsworthy writes, and I quote, "There is no reason to believe that the Roman army did not adapt its tactics, formations, and equipment to local circumstances. I couldn't agree more." And Polybius, as we shall see in Lecture 19, specifically ascribes the legion's success to its flexibility. Tactical flexibility was the point of the manipular deployment, and Livy's schematic and mechanical system obscures that fact. For that reason alone, it ought to be treated very cautiously. Roman infantry combat differed from the hoplite or phalanx form of warfare in several respects. For a start, it lasted longer. Roman battles are regularly said to have lasted until the sunset or even all day. A clash of Roman infantry cohorts in Spain during Caesar's civil wars dragged on for 5 hours, and the Battle of Pydna, fought in 168 BC, which we'll examine in Lecture 19, was considered unusual in that a decision was reached in just 1 hour. The legionary's reliance on the javelin meant that missiles were a more persistent feature of Roman battle than they were of hoplite or Macedonian engagements. But the use of the sword as the primary weapon is the really distinctive feature of Roman legionary combat. Swordplay required the Romans to get very close and to allow enough room for each soldier to wield his weapons, so they were probably stationed 6 feet apart so they could swing their weapons around. How did such combat actually play out? What was it like? Given the issue of duration especially, one recent view is that Roman infantry battles were not as intense as is usually imagined. If an enemy did not break immediately, engagements would settle down into standoffs with plenty of bluster and missile throwing, but not a lot of close fighting going on. Men are psychologically predisposed to save their own skins, and so Roman legionaries would crouch behind their large shields and hurl missiles and insults from a distance. Some units might draw swords and charge, and so the line undulated back and forth down its length. What really mattered was who would buckle first. Once the breaking point was reached, either through fatigue or too many missile casualties, or perhaps a concerted well-timed charge with swords, then the real slaughter began as fleeing troops were mercilessly chased down, especially by the cavalry. That the losers of Roman battles often incurred losses several orders of magnitude greater than the winners shows that the undecided combat took very few lives, since it was so tentative. So, at least, goes this model. But grafting one model of combat onto all Roman battles is, to my mind, perilous, to say the least, since the Roman sources present us with a bewildering variety of combat situations in a wide variety of terrains, against enemies as diverse as hordes of Celts, disciplined ranks of Macedonian phalangites, or even fellow Romans. One model fits all is unlikely to apply in such diverse encounters. The point about the psychological imperative of survival is well taken, but it does not entail tentativeness as a necessary feature of Roman combat. We have already noted warriors who willingly risk their lives and go into shock battles virtually unarmored or even naked. In war, aggression can be the best form of defense. The disproportion in casualties between winners and losers is a constant in most ancient battles, and again, does not require tentativeness either. The sources are clear that Roman battles, as we'll be seeing soon enough, were often ferocious and brutal affairs. I think a vital factor here is that the fighting spirit that was instilled by the small unit cohesion gave the Romans a certain mental toughness. Sheer staying power accounts for much in any combat situation. The side that loses heart first loses the fight. Modern psychological studies have shown that soldiers fight primarily to save face, to avoid the appearance of cowardice, and to secure the lives of their friends. The standards carried by the Roman legion, maniple and century, offered psychological reference points for the loyalty of the soldiers, and the quartering of troops in eight-man tents, called contubernia, promoted small unit cohesion. The mode of recruitment meant that each member of each contubernium would share the same social class and age group as his fellows. These same men then fought side by side in their maniples, which were made up also of social peers and age group contemporaries. Not wishing to let one's comrades down gave the legionary the extra boost not only to stay and fight, but to be seen to stay and fight. The culture of public shame added further incentives to actually stick it out. After battle, cowards were singled out, publicly humiliated and punished. The brave were singled out, publicly praised and rewarded. In my view, this small unit cohesion is the key to the Roman success in battle. The Romans harnessed it like none other before them, and that was the linchpin of their success. In contemplating the harsh realities of ancient battle, the modern imagination is lured to very dark places indeed. Some scholars conjure images of the combatants caked in blood from head to toe, the ground beneath their feet carpeted literally with bodies, spilled innards and butchered body parts. Blood and exposed intestines have a distinct smell, the pungency of which was intensified by the sweat of exertion and the urine and feces that can issue involuntarily from men in combat. Amidst all of this detritus and effluent, it must have taken great effort just to stay on one's feet. The prominence of swordplay in Roman combat added considerably to the horror. The Spanish sword wielded by the Romans inflicted particularly hideous wounds, even by ancient standards. Livy reports, for instance, how in 200 BC, a Macedonian army saw the corpses of some of their comrades killed in a skirmish with the Romans, and here is what he writes. They had seen wounds caused by spears, arrows, and rarely by lances. since they were accustomed to fighting with Greeks and Illyrians. But now they saw bodies dismembered with the Spanish sword, arms cut off with the shoulder attached, or heads severed from bodies, with the necks completely cut through, internal organs exposed, and other horrible wounds. And a general feeling of panic ensued when they discovered the kind of weapon and the kind of men they had to contend with. Such are the horrors that lie behind the common throwaway phrase that ends so many Roman battle narratives, caedes magna fuit, there was great slaughter. Let us now turn to some specific engagements.